By way of introduction, if I was preaching regularly with you, I would probably go through the entire book of Job in maybe five or six sermons. But as that's not the case, I do want to give you something of an overview. I feel that would be important for you to understand the message of the book of Job and what the book of Job teaches us. It is intended to be read. Actually, many of the books of the Bible were intended to be read from beginning to end and to be understood in that way. And that's especially true with the book of Job. The book of Job can really be divided into three parts. Part one could be described as a prologue. Part two could be described as a dialogue, and part three could be described as an epilogue. Now, the prologue is in chapters 1 through chapter 3. That provides us with the foundation and the background to the whole of the book. You would not be able to understand the rest of the book unless you were to read the first three chapters. And then part two stretches from chapter 4 through really to chapter 38. And in those chapters, we have a dialogue. That's a conversation between Job and his three friends. If you are familiar with the book of Job, you'll see that each of his three friends take it in turn to speak to Job, and Job also responds to them. Sometimes he responds to them all together, or sometimes he responds to them one at a time. And that's the dialogue. And during the dialogue section, we never hear the voice of God speaking. God is, in a sense, his presence is absent from the dialogue that happens between Job and his friends. And then in chapter 38, to the very end of the book, we have the epilogue. And this is where the Lord begins to speak, and he begins to say things, especially in the very last chapter. In chapter 42, the Lord addresses Job's friends. So this morning, we're going to be dealing primarily with the prologue. And then this afternoon, I'm going to be speaking about chapter 23. Chapter 23 gives us something of a summary of really the whole of the dialogue and how Job feels about that and how he is responding to that. And we might touch a little bit on the epilogue at the end if we have time. So let's look at the prologue this morning. One of the questions that is asked through the entire book of Job, and it's a question that's usually asked by people who are suffering intensively, or who are friends or perhaps family members of others who are suffering, and that is the question, why? And that's a question that was uppermost in Job's mind. Why? Why is this happening? I'm sure that you can agree with that. I'm sure that you've probably asked that question in times of struggle, whether it be physical or spiritual. The question comes to our minds, why? Why is this happening? And it's usually a question that's charged with emotion, especially in the face of tragedy and intense suffering. It could be a question that's asked by any number of people here this morning. Why do I have to go through this suffering? So this is a question that was in Job's minds and in the minds of his three friends. Now, the only conclusion, and this is important, that Job's three friends could come to was that Job must have been harbouring or had committed some kind of secret sin that had brought God's judgment upon him in retribution for his sin. If you were to turn to John chapter 9, you'll see there's something that happens there in the life and ministry of Jesus, which illustrates this. You remember, a man is brought to Jesus in John chapter 9 who was born blind. And Jesus is asked the question, who sinned that this man was born blind? You remember what Jesus says? He says, neither. They say, was it him or was it his parents? And Jesus says, it was neither. This man was born in this way in order that the works of God might be glorified in him. So what does that tell us? It tells us that in every case of suffering, it's not necessarily the case that suffering results as a punishment or as a result of some sin. Sometimes suffering comes to us for another purpose other than sin. Now, you could argue that all suffering is in the world as a result of the fall of man and therefore is in the world as a result of sin. Yes, we would say that, generally speaking, that is the case. But not all suffering that comes to God's people is necessarily a punishment for sin. And Jesus illustrates that in John chapter 9. Now, there's perhaps no other place in Scripture where you find so much information on human suffering than in the book of Job. Perhaps the Psalms of Lament would become a close second. Why do we suffer when it's not directly related to particular sin? That was the case with Job. And why was Job never told why he suffered? You know, it's interesting. Joni Erickson, I'm sure that many of you, maybe the older people, will know who Joni Erickson was. She was a young Christian woman. She had a diving accident when she was really young. She dove into a swimming pool and she had misjudged the depth of the water and she hit her head on the floor of the pool and she became paralyzed from the neck down. She became a paraplegic. She couldn't move her arms or her legs and ended up in a wheelchair. And when she was in the hospital, just in the days following her accident, the doctors came and told her she would never be able to use her arms and her legs ever again. Now, she was just, I think she was probably in her low 20s, or maybe she was just still a teenager at the time. But she was asking this question of God, why? Why is this happening to me? And the first place that Joni turned to was the book of Job. And she looked for answers in the book of Job. And she relates this in her book, in one of her books where she writes about this. And she said, you know, along with Job, I found that there was no answer. I couldn't find the answer. I couldn't get the answer to the question, why is this happening to me? And she came to the conclusion that if God were to give her the answer, it would be like pouring 1 million gallons of water into a paper cup. She wouldn't be able to handle the answer to the question. Now, some 50 or perhaps 60 years later, Joni Erickson can now look back and she can answer that question because as a result of her accident, she had a thriving ministry to disabled people. And so now, with hindsight, she could look back. And I'm sure that Job, now in heaven and glory, can look back and see that there was a purpose for his suffering. There is always a purpose for suffering, but we're not always told why it happens. So this is never revealed to Job. There's never a point in the book of Job where God says to Job, this is the reason why this happened to you. You won't find it. It's nowhere in the book of Job. The question is never answered. So, chapter 1 and verses 6 through 12 and chapter 2 verses 1 through 6 provide the background that Job never sees. So there's a conference, if you like, that takes place in heaven between the sons of God and Satan and God himself, right? And Job, it's never revealed to Job that this happened. Job is never given this information. God or no one else comes to Job and says, now Satan has come and challenge me concerning you, and this is what's going to happen to you. Unlike, you know, when Jesus said to Peter, Satan has desired to sift you as wheat. Now, Jesus already gave Peter that information before it happened to him, but that never happened with Job. Job was never informed about what had happened and the counsels of heaven and the spiritual realm, why these things were happening to him. But that provides the context for everything that happens. These verses tell us that it's the Lord who grants Satan permission to afflict Job, much in the same way that Jesus informed Peter that Satan had asked permission to sift him as wheat. There is an important lesson there for us, and it's this, that God is ultimately controlling these events. Remember when Satan comes and cites God against him and says, take away everything he has and he'll curse you to your face. And what does God do? He says to Satan, he hands Job over to Satan to sift him as wheat as you were. He does it twice in chapter 1 and then in chapter 2. Remember when Satan comes back and the Lord says to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Everything has happened to him, and he hasn't cursed me to my face. He's lost everything. He's lost his children, his business. He's lost everything except his wife. And he hasn't cursed me to my face. And what does Satan say? Skin for skin. Does Job serve God for nothing? And then God hands Job over to Satan again and allows him to afflict him with boils. But God is controlling the events. Satan has to ask permission. He can't go further than what God has allowed him to go. And that's the first lesson that we need to learn here. You know, it's incidental that it's helpful to notice something else from the passage. In verse 7 and also in verse 2 of chapter 2, remember God says to Satan, from where have you come? And what does Satan say? From going to and forth on the earth and walking up and down on it. What does that tell us about Satan? It tells us that Satan does not have the ability to be everywhere at the same time as God does. Satan is walking up and down on the earth and going to and fro on it. Satan does not have the divine, I'm looking for the word here, can't remember the word. It's what happens when you get older. Attribute. He doesn't have the divine attribute of omnipresence. I'm sure Pastor Mordyke has explained that term to you. Omnipresence means to be everywhere present. God is present in all places, at all times, in every age. There's no place where God is not present. He's even present in hell. His divine wrath is present in hell. But there's no place in all of creation where God is not present. Satan does not have that ability. And that's important for us to remember that as Christians. He does not have the ability to be everywhere at the same time. His knowledge is limited. His presence is limited. His power is limited. And it's limited by God. It's a bit like those of us who have dogs, and you have one of those retractable leashes, you know, those things where you can let the dog go so far and you press a button and it stops the leash, it locks it and it stops the dog from going any further. That's what Satan is like. He's like a dog on a leash. I think it was Martin Luther that said, Satan is God's Satan. And the Lord allows him to go so far and doesn't allow him to go any further than God has determined for him to go. And so God hands Job over to Satan. Satan is limited. God is not. He cannot go further than God permits him. Now that's the background here for our text. There's this conference that takes place in heaven. between the sons of God, and Satan is there with them, and he has this conversation with God. Let's get to the point now. There's really three things that I want to say, and I want to focus more on Job now. And there's three things that we learn from Job in these first two chapters. The first thing we learn about is Job's character. And the second thing we learn about is Job's crisis. And the third thing, Job's conclusion. His character, his crisis, and his conclusion. Now, verse 1 tells us something about the character of Job, that he was a man who was above reproach, who was righteous, and who shunned evil. And not only that, not only the writer to the book of Job states this, but God himself. And that's important for us to remember as we go through this story. God himself declares Job to be righteous in verse 8 and in chapter 2 and verse 3. God himself declares Job to be a righteous man. Now, if you were to look for evidence of that in the book of Job, you would turn to Job chapter 29, where we read there that Job was one of the elders of his town, and he would sit at the gate of the town, of the city. And whenever Job spoke, all of the other men would become silent. He was a man of wisdom, and he sought out the poor. So not only was he a wise man, he was a benevolent man. He was always looking out for poor people, and he was always giving wisdom. He was a teacher in Israel. And God himself says that he is the most righteous man on the face of the earth in his day. That's important for us to remember in terms of Job's suffering. For we see that Job is not suffering as a result of any sin that he has committed, because God himself declares Job to be a righteous man. We see that also in the first two chapters, where Job is offering sacrifices for his children, and he's praying for them, and it says in the text that he does this regularly. So not only is he a good elder in Israel, not only is he the most righteous man on the face of the earth in his day, he's a good father also. So he's everything that a man should be, a man of God should be. He's a holy and an upright and a righteous man. He was perfect and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He was above reproach. He was the kind of man that nobody could find anything against. You would never catch Job off his guard, because he never needed to be on it. You know how sometimes we need to be on our guard? Perhaps you've lied, or you've told a half-truth, or as we like to call them, a white lie. And then someone else says to you, but hang on, you said something else earlier, and then you get confused. You've got to try and keep on your game, right, when you tell lies, and when you do something dishonest. Job never needed to be like that, because he was totally honest. He never lied. He was the most righteous man on the face of the earth in his day. Nobody could find Job off his guard, because he never needed to be on it. He was the most righteous man on the earth, according to God in verse 8. He showed all the signs of the fruits of the Spirit in his character. And this is what would stand Job in good stead amidst the trials that would come into his life. He was a man who had experienced the grace of God, and it showed in his character, and it showed how he responded to adversity and testing. So we need to stop here and think about that for a minute. How do you respond? How do I respond to adversity and testing and trials and challenges in my life? The theologian Sinclair Ferguson has said, it's your reactions that often define you more than your actions, because your actions are usually premeditated, aren't they? You know, even when you got up this morning, right? When you got out of bed this morning, you got in the shower, you put good clothes on, If you're a man, you shaved. If you're a woman, you probably put makeup on. And you looked in the mirror. I'm sure that probably everyone here this morning looked in a mirror and made sure that your appearance was just right. It was premeditated. Your action was premeditated. But it's your reaction that really tells the kind of person that you are. How do you react when someone offends you? How do you react when some suffering comes into your life, when some adversity comes into your life? How do you react when someone runs the stop sign in front of you when it was your turn to go? Or someone runs a red light? Or someone cuts you off? How do you react when someone shows anger towards you? And this is what was important here in Job's life. How did Job react? We see how Job reacted. Your reactions define you more, or betray to others more who you really are, more than your actions. An illustration was given to this. I don't know if Sharif, did Sharif ever come and preach here from Egypt when he was at the seminary? No, maybe not. Probably wasn't allowed to come to Canada. So Sharif and Ian McLeod, you all know Ian McLeod. Sharif and Ian McLeod and I all have one thing in common. We all love soccer. It's our favourite sport. And we all have our teams that we support. So Ian and I support a team called Glasgow Rangers. And whenever they play Celtic, we don't like Celtic, right? Or whenever they play England, I'm sure it's the same here with hockey or baseball or whatever game you play. There are certain teams that you don't like. And when your team's playing against that team, you don't want that team to win. And Sharif was using this as an illustration once, and he used soccer, and he was talking about this relationship that the one set of fans has with another. And I was saying to Sharif after we had the meeting, I said, you know, when Rangers play Celtic or when Scotland play England, I become another person. And he said, no, you become who you are. That's who you really are, because your reactions betrays what you're really like. And that's what you're really like. And that stung. But he said it with a smile on his face. But that was not the case with Job. How did Job react in these circumstances? He worshipped God. See what happened at the end of the first part when he lost everything? He tore his robes. He shaved his head. He fell on the ground. And he worshipped God. That was the response to the trial that was happening in Job's life. He worshipped God. And that should be our response. That should be my response. When I go through trials and suffering, I worship God. What did Job say? The Lord has given and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. You see, it's usually our reactions that define us or betray us more than our actions. So how would you react in such a crisis as Job's? Can you imagine how you would feel if you were to go home from church today and find your house burned to the ground? And you call the insurance company, and the insurance company tells you, your insurance has lapsed. You have no insurance. And you can't rebuild your house because you've lost it. And then you call the bank and the bank say, we've closed your account. Oh, there's no money in your accounts. It's all gone. And then you find out that all your children have died. They were perhaps on their way home from church in another vehicle and they died. How would you react in such a crisis? Well, we're going to see how Job did by looking at his crisis, number two, or point number two. So there's four mind-numbing, cataclysmic and overlapping events that must have shocked him to his core. Imagine how Job must have felt as these men were coming to him. No sooner had one man finished speaking than the next one arrives with the next landslide of bad news, with the next stage of Job's crisis. He's gone from being the richest man in his community to being a pauper. He's made utterly destitute. He's absolutely nothing. He even loses his friends who think he is being punished for his sin. We're going to look at that more this afternoon. Job's friends think that Job must have committed some kind of sin, and that's why he's suffering so much. So even his friends have turned their back on him. And not only that, but his wife also. Remember what his wife says? Why don't you just curse God and die? So Job is left with no one and nothing. Just try and get into the mind of Job this morning and think, how would that make you feel if you were to lose absolutely everything? All of your brothers and sisters, your mum and your dad, your kids, whatever. Your whole family gone, with perhaps just your wife or your husband left. And that wife or husband saying, why don't you just curse God and be done with this and die? Imagine how you would feel in such a crisis. You know, it would be easy for us, as it was for Job's friends, to draw the wrong conclusion about his predicament. His friends are thinking that he's being punished, because they're saying that it's not possible for a man to go through so much and there not be something wrong in his life. You know, that's important for us to remember also, I think. Because it might be the case that someone in this congregation is going through deep trials right now, and some of us are drawing the wrong conclusions about that. We had a man in one of our congregations, not in the Free Church, this is another denomination, and he was extremely overweight, this man. He weighed about 500 or 600 pounds, and one of the ladies, a thin lady, said, I overheard her saying about him, you know that man there, he just hasn't looked after himself. He's eating all the wrong food, and he's not caring for the Lord's temple, which is his body. Now, what she didn't realize was that this man had a glandular condition. And it was such a rare condition that whenever he ate food, it just turned to fat. His body was not able to process food properly so that it would not turn to fat. He had a glandular problem. And he didn't eat very much at all. But his body just kept growing. He just kept putting on weight. And it didn't matter what he ate, he just kept putting on weight. Because his body, it was a physical ailment. It was a physical condition. It was a medical condition that he had. And yet this woman had drawn the wrong conclusion and was thinking, judging. That's why Jesus says we shouldn't judge each other, right? Because you just don't know what's happening in a person's life. And we can't come to these kind of conclusions. When someone is suffering, it's not always the case that it's as a result of sin. In fact, I would go so far as to say that any suffering, if you're a Christian here this morning, that any suffering that you are experiencing is never punishment for sin. It never is. And why is that? Because if you're a Christian, someone else has already been punished for that sin. Double jeopardy. You have that legal term here, right? Double jeopardy. You can't be tried twice for the same crime. Well, it's the same in the spiritual realm. If you're a believer here this morning, your sin has already been punished on the cross. And you will never be punished for any sin that you commit. You will be disciplined. Hebrews 6 tells us that the Lord disciplines the sons that he loves, the children that he loves. But you're never punished. That's something we need to get straight in our minds. You will never be punished for your sin, because that has already been dealt with on the head of Jesus Christ. You may be disciplined, but you won't be punished. There is a difference. But Job wasn't even being disciplined for some secret sin. This was innocent suffering. God never punishes twice for the same thing. So our third point then is that we need to look at Job's conclusion. We've looked at his character. He's the most righteous man on the earth. And that's by God's own mouth that God says that about Job, that he is righteous and he shuns evil. The second thing is that we've looked at his crisis. We've seen what happened to him. Now, what's Job's conclusion, or what's Job's reaction to that? How does Job respond to the suffering? And I think that's the important lesson for us here this morning. How do we respond to trials and suffering and hardship in the Christian life? What is our conclusion? What was Job's conclusion? Well, it's interesting, even though he did not see or hear anything of the conference that had taken place in the spiritual realm between Satan and God, Job recognized one thing, and here's the important thing. Job recognized that it was God who gave him all that he had, and that it was God who had taken it away. Ultimately, Job could see the hand of God in this. And that's what's important for us. We need to see that the hand of God is in these trials and these sufferings. He even blesses God for it. In verse 22, tells us that he did not sin or charge God for his calamity. Even though he recognized that God had removed everything from his life, he's not bitter about it. But you see, even in the midst of this terrible affliction, Job knew something else. He didn't just know that God had given it to him and that God ultimately had taken it away from him. He came to an even greater conclusion than his view of the providence of God in all things. That there was a sense in which there was a deeper conclusion underneath the conclusion that Job draws here. Later in chapter 19, if you read through the book of Job, you'll see this. In verses 25 and 26, we learn that Job had a long-term view here. He always had this view. In Job 19, verses 25 and 26, Job says, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and that on the last day I will see him standing on the earth, and that I will be in my flesh." Job knows that he's going to die. But yet, he's looking forward to a day in which he sees his Redeemer standing on the earth. Now, what is this pointing to? Job is pointing forward to the incarnation and the resurrection. Job has already stated that he knows that his flesh will decay in the grave. And yet he says that he knows that there's going to be a day where he sees his Redeemer standing on the earth and that he will see him in his flesh. He's pointing forward. He's looking forward. He's looking through time, as it were. And he's seeing that there is a day when the Redeemer will stand on the earth. He's looking forward to the incarnation and the resurrection. You see, Job's faith in God is never shaken because a right view of the sovereignty and the providence of God. And you need to have that when you're going through trials. You need to have a right view of the sovereignty of God, that he is in control of all things, but also of the providence of God, that he has directed all these things, that he ultimately brings these things around, brings these things about, and that ultimately
He will stand on the earth, and that you as a believer will see him face to face.
There may be other lessons for Job to learn as his suffering increases, especially as he undergoes this physical suffering with these painful boils on his body. But you need to, there's something else we need to see here, and that is that Job is a type. Augustine has said that you will never understand the message of the Old Testament until you see it in the light of the New Testament. And you'll never understand the message of the New Testament until you see it in the Old Testament. He uses this phrase. He says, the new is in the old, concealed. And the old is in the new, revealed. The New Testament, the message of the New Testament, is in the Old Testament, but it's concealed. And you get a glimpse of it in certain places. Job had a glimpse of it in chapter 19. But that which is hidden in the Old Testament is revealed in the New Testament. That's why Jesus on the road to Emmaus says to the two disciples that he's walking with, he asked them what they were speaking about, and they say to him, don't you know what's been happening about the Jesus of Nazareth who was dead and buried? And he said he would rise again, but we don't know what's happened to him. And then Jesus, beginning with the law and the prophets, begins to unfold to them everything that was written there concerning himself. Jesus is referring to the Old Testament. And he is the one who has a revelation of that. And Job had that long-term view. He had that ultimate conclusion. You see, Job experienced the absence and the felt presence of God in his trials. But the Redeemer he knows, he knows he will see in his future resurrected flesh. And he also knows that this Redeemer will also experience abandonment from God. He's pointing to one who has a similar experience to Job. One who says, my God, why have you forsaken me? You see, God does eventually reveal himself to Job in ways that Job had never known. You see that in chapters 38 to chapter 42. And when Job is restored, he gets a double portion of everything that he lost initially. There's a sense in which Job's cry of dereliction is eventually answered. But the one that Job is pointing to, the Redeemer that he knows will stand on the earth, his cry of dereliction goes unanswered from the cross, because he was assigned to death. Nothing that Job experienced came close to the spiritual anguish that Jesus felt, because Job was never punished for his sin. His Redeemer was, and he saw this. Job experienced discipline. It was harsh, but it was not directly related to his sin as punishment. It couldn't be, because he was declared righteous by God, you remember. Job knew there was a long-term conclusion. His short-term conclusion was, the Lord has given and the Lord has taken away. That was his short-term. But he knew his God, and he knew that his God knew him, and his faith was never shaken. It's interesting that Job's faith was never shaken. It was firm to the end. His anchor was firm. He never denies the existence of God. He never curses God. He never blames God for what's happening to him. He attributes everything that's happening to him as coming from God, because his firmness of affliction was his ultimate blessing, because his restoration
is typological of a heavenly future. And that's how we need to see the book of Job. It's really a picture of the Christian life in a sense. Trials, tribulation, but in the end, a heavenly hope and a heavenly promise. Job ended with more than he lost. And that's the case for the Christian. In the end, we will gain more than we ever lose in this life. Now, I don't really know anyone here intimately well. I know a few of you. I've been in some of your homes and I've gotten to know some of you. But I don't know everyone intimately. But I can say this with confidence about everyone in the room who is a believer, that you will experience affliction. It comes to every one of us eventually. It will come. And it comes in different forms sometimes. And that form is usually suited to what exactly God is doing in your life. I can say this with confidence also, that God is the one who controls the level of the intensity of the suffering in your life in the way that he did in Job's life. Satan is on a leash and he's not allowed to go any further than God allows him. But here's the test, and with this I close. Here's the test, and this is a test for the Christian and the non-Christian. There might be unbelievers here this morning. You may have never come to the foot of the cross. And so here's the question. Can you say with Job, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that at the last he will stand upon the earth, and I will see him in my flesh? Can you say that this morning? Can you say, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that he will stand on the earth, because he will stand on the earth? And will you be able, with Job, to worship him? That's my prayer this morning. Let's pray. Father, we do thank you for your word to us from Job, from his experience. We know, Lord, that there's probably no man that ever lived since then who's experienced so much of a trial as he did. But we know also, Lord, that this is a picture of Christ himself, who went through an even deeper level of intensity of suffering and cried out and yet heard nothing come back from heaven, but gave himself up to the cross and to the curse of sin, so that for those who have placed their faith in him, those can say, I know that my Redeemer lives, and I know that I will see him at the last in my flesh. Oh Lord, let that be the conclusion for all of us here this morning, we ask in Jesus' name.